Today's Talk 10 Tuesday is sponsored by Ipsapalooza. Get ready to conquer the 2024 ICD-10 code changes with expert guidance. Click on the link in the comments section to learn more. We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for August 22nd, 2023. Today, we welcome Dr. James Kennedy to report on the release of the patient safety indicator methodology. Lori Johnson has up-to-the-minute coding news. Tiffany Ferguson explores the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her TalkBack segment. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a man who wonders, how long do we have to keep saying formerly known as Twitter, Chuck Buck?
Oh, wow. Thanks, Clark. Anthony, very much. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 566th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Good morning, Erica. And Erica, as you heard, Clark Anthony announced Dr. James Kennedy returns to the broadcast today to report on the release of the patient safety indicator methodology. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I think it was very funny what how he introduced you this morning. And I am very interested to hear what Jim has to say about the changes in the patient safety indicators.
Very good. So, Erica, what's the topic for your TalkBack segment today?
I'm going to talk about the 2024 final rule and the procedures purportedly unrelated to the diagnosis, the principal diagnosis.
Excellent topic, Erica. We look forward very much to hearing your TalkBack. We have much news to report, folks. So we begin this morning with Tim Powell. He is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Thanks, Chuck. And today I'm going to be talking about the critical need for excess beds in acute hospital settings. In the complex landscape of healthcare, hospital bed availability often plays a pivotal role in the effective management of patients. A crucial yet sometimes overlooked aspect of healthcare planning is the need for excess beds, particularly in the hospital acute setting. According to data from sources like the Kaiser Family Foundation, the number of hospital beds available per 1,000 population has been on a downward trend in many regions for many years. As the COVID pandemic has amply demonstrated, the absence of extra beds can put an enormous strain on the healthcare system, affecting both patients and medical professionals adversely. So why are excess beds necessary in an acute setting? First, there's emergency preparedness. One of the most compelling arguments for having excess beds is to be prepared for unexpected emergencies. Natural disasters and epidemics or mass casualty events can quickly overload a healthcare system that's operating at or near full capacity. Next is seasonal variations. Certain times of the year, such as flu season, see a significant increase in hospital admissions, and extra beds can absorb the influx of patients requiring acute care during these periods. Next is surgical scheduling. Hospitals often have to schedule non-emergency surgeries around bed availability. A buffer of extra beds allows for a more flexible scheduling, thereby improving patient outcomes and satisfaction. Next is transfers and patient flow. Acute care hospitals often receive patients transferred from other facilities, emergency departments, or outpatient settings, and having a cushion of extra beds can facilitate a smoother transition and minimize delays. And finally is staff flexibility. Extra beds provide staff the room to manage patient care more effectively. When there are more beds available, staff can be deployed more efficiently, and it becomes easier to maintain optimal nurse-to-patient ratios, thus improving the quality of care. But the data does speak, and while exact numbers may vary on location and facility, some reports from the Kaiser Family Foundation indicate that the United States has been experiencing a decline in the number of hospital beds over the last few decades. This downsizing, often done to cut costs, leaves little room for flexibility in case of sudden increases in demand. For instance, the Kaiser data has shown that the number of hospital beds per 1,000 population fell from 3.0 in 1990 to only 2.4 in 2018. This reduction might seem modest, but when applied to an acute care setting already operating at a high capacity, it poses significant challenges in accommodating unexpected spikes in patient numbers. And then there are economic constraints versus public health needs. The operational costs of maintaining excess beds are often cited as the primary reason against it. However, the alternative, a lack of readiness in the face of a crisis, can be much more expensive in terms of both human lives and long-term economic impact. Investment in excess beds should thus be viewed not as a cost, but as a form of insurance against future crises, seasonal peaks, and unforeseen events that can disrupt the normal functioning of the healthcare system. In conclusion, while efficiency and resource management are vital in healthcare, a singular focus on these aspects should not compromise the system's ability to deal with acute needs. The data, including those from reputable organizations like the Kaiser Family Foundation, suggests that the need for excess beds in acute hospital settings is not just a matter of practicality, but a critical component in delivering quality healthcare. By understanding the necessity for a buffer in bed capacity, healthcare providers and policymakers can better prepare for both routine and healthcare delivery unexpected crises, ensuring a more robust, responsive, and resilient healthcare system for all. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. Now's the time for the Coding Report with Laurie Johnson. And good morning, Laurie Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica. And hello to our listeners. Last week, I discussed the procedure tentative agenda for the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting, which is scheduled for September 12th and 13th. The meeting will start with the procedure proposals and then move to the diagnosis applications. There are 28 topics on the diagnosis agenda, plus the addenda. A few of the topics are related to the fiscal year 24 new diagnosis code, such as family history of adenomatous polyposis and personal history of colonic polyps. There are some coding basics, such as coding of firearm injuries default and encounter for prophylactic removal of fallopian tubes for persons with no known genetic familial risk factors, and injection drug use. There are many new topics, such as adverse effects of immune checkpoint to inhibitor immunotherapy, anal fistula, baked egg and milk egg tolerance, cement and fat pulmonary emboli, Duffy phenotype, early stage type 1 diabetes, lymphoma in remission, pediatric body mass index. And there are some syndromes that we will learn about, serotonin syndrome and Usher syndrome. This meeting is virtual and you must register to attend. The schedule is to meet from 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The lunch break is from 12:30 to 1:30 p.m. The meeting will reconvene from 1:30 to 5 o'clock p.m. The schedule will be the same for both days. All times are Eastern Time. It looks like a packed agenda for this fall meeting. I would encourage you to attend and provide commentary. You will learn the spirit of the code. The registration link is available in my article, New Diagnosis and Procedure Codes on the Horizon, that's available on icd10monitor.com, as well as the links to the tentative agenda. And Cheyenne has made them available here on the screen. So with that, Erica, back to you.
Thanks, Lori. I can't wait for the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC.
Attention coding professionals and all HIM professionals. Now available on demand is the 3-day webcast series you need to hear to remain compliant with the 2024 Inpatient Prospective Payment System. It's the IPPS Coding Summit, produced by ICD-10 Monitor. During this exclusive 3-part summit, you learn the important changes associated with the 2024 IPS, including new ICD-10 CM and PCS codes, plus insights, analysis, and answers to questions. Register now to listen and learn with the on-demand IPS Coding Summit. On day one, you'll learn changes to the ICD-10 CM codes. Day two is all about changes to PCS codes. And day three includes information about important changes to MSDRGs and the new technology add-on payment codes. That's the IPPS Coding Summit, produced by ICD-10 Monitor. Now available on demand at the ICD Monitor Bookstore.
Now it's time for the Talking Tuesday report on the social determinants of health. However, this morning we're going to hear something else about CDI and the integration, perhaps, with utilization review. And here now for that report is Tiffany Ferguson. Good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, all. So there's a growing interest in the intersection of utilization review and clinical documentation integrity. With greater changes to more UR and CDI staff going remote and case management being left in the hospital, I can't tell you how often Dr. Reamer and I are asked to speak about the partnership between CDI and UR, and together we've really learned a lot about how closely these two professions align. Recently, ACTIS responded to a public question about the potential for greater collaboration with utilization management and even cross-training of team members. The question confirms the growing interest, but I have to tell you, there wasn't enough space for them to respond, and I'm wanting more. So here is the response I would give. Absolutely, it is time for UR and CDI to look further for further collaboration and intersection, and for a multitude of growing reasons. The number one is they have long been specialists both on the quest to support clinical documentation and medical necessity for accurate revenue capture. They often collaborate with physician advisors who are often expected to cover both areas in their role, depending on the hospital size. Greater alignment would benefit the PAs. From a physician standpoint, there is often confusion between the role of both groups play, as they are often seen sometimes as people that are bugging the physicians about their documentation. Greater coordination and specifically collaborative education and discussions with the physicians would eliminate multiple intrusions. From a denials perspective, it is already a pass the baton approach between UR and CDI as to who caused the denial. Medical necessity or a DRG downgrade. The payers even sometimes use both reasons of clinical validation and medical necessity in their justification to deny, leaving the siloed CDIS and UR specialists confused as to who is expected to write the letter. Technology is already working to integrate both disciplines. Without mentioning names, the same techniques for UR and CDI are being configured and rolled out for the efficiency across lines. The machine learning and algorithms being built to pull documentation or identify opportunities for abnormal lab values prove great benefits to the CDIS and the UR specialist. Finally, they need each other. How often does the CDIS review a record and provide a primary diagnosis, maybe even a query, to the physician only for it to be downgraded to observation services after a UR review? Or how about the denial that comes through for a short stay hospitalization, and despite the clear and concise documentation by the physician, thanks to the greater efforts of the CDIS and the coder, the case does not present the relevant medical necessity to even pass the 2-midnight rule. Finally, how often does the UR team scour the record to find justification for a continued hospitalization to provide criteria and clinical documentation to the payer when the CDIS has already completed a beautiful review that is sometimes not even visible in the record to the UR specialist to use? So when the question is asked for greater collaboration between CDI and UR, the unequivocal answer is yes. And with that, back to you, Erica.
Couldn't agree more. And, you know, it could be something as easy as, instead of trying to get the doctor to document persistent altered mental status, have them document metabolic encephalopathy and kill two birds with one stone. Thanks, Tiffany. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is the CEO for Phoenix Medical Management.
What do you do when CMS unloads barrels of new codes into your lap like fallen leaves? How do you stay on top of your game as a coding genius? You subscribe to the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Portal. For an unbelievably low subscription of $35, you have access to the superstars of coding, Gloria Ann Bryant, Dr. Erica Reamer, and Lori Johnson. You also have access to more than 40 educational webcasts. Plus, you'll earn CEUs to maintain your credentials. The retail value, more than $5,960. But for a limited time, your subscription is only $35 per webcast, a savings of 75%. Subscribe today to the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Portal.
As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, Dr. James Kennedy is with us this morning. He's going to report on the patient safety indicator methodology. It was released last week by the Agency for Health Care Research and Quality. Good morning, Dr. Jim. What do we really need to know today?
Thank you so much for having me. And Erica, good to see you. AHRQ patient safety indicators have two main effects on hospitals. One is that it affects the reputation of the facility as it relates to the CMS Hospital Compare website and also to LeapFrog. So how we look on the PSIs is based upon documentation and coding, of course. Second is that the AHRQ patient safety indicators contribute to the CMS hospital acquired condition methodology that for hospitals that are below the 25th percentile, there is a 1% reduction in their inpatient reimbursement. So therefore, our paying attention to PSIs is extremely crucial. Now, one of the quirks about PSIs is that AHRQ waits until 9 or 10 months into a fiscal year before they release the methodology for that year. So therefore, the fiscal year 2023 methodology was not released until about a couple of weeks ago. So we're already 9 months down into this, but nevertheless, we do need to pay attention because what they release for this year will also likely be in place for next year. So what are the key points? Number one, in previous years, COVID cases were excluded. Well, now COVID cases are included, which means that in our decision-making, our definitions, our diagnosis, our documentation, we have to determine whether or not the patient has a history of COVID with no sequela or has sequela without a current active infection, or the presence of active COVID. It is the presence of active COVID that risk adjusts in PSIs, not the sequela, not the history of no longer present, not being treated. So therefore, that is a key CDI opportunity for us. The second major change in the PSIs is that prior to fiscal year 2023, hospital-acquired hip fractures were included. Now it's all fractures are included if they are not present on admission or present at the time of the inpatient order. POA is a very, very crucial aspect of this, which yes means yes, no means no, cannot be clinically determined means yes under AHRQ PSIs. So being certain that the fracture was present at the time of the inpatient admission is a crucial element of this. Also, the relative weight used to be only 1.5% of the PSI 90 calculation. They've increased it to 5%. So hospital-acquired fractures now is a new CDI focus, and that number is going to go up and thus has to be explained to the quality officers and such as to why that number went up. The methodology changed. Now, a key aspect of this is that in my experience, most hospital-acquired fractures are not the true traumatic fractures, like a car wreck or something. Most of them are fragility fractures. These are fractures that occur at a standing height or less. Now, osteoporotic fractures are included in this method. However, pathological fractures due to other conditions, such as malignancy, multiple myeloma, the M84 codes, are not included. So therefore, CDI opportunities as it relates to whether or not the hospital-acquired fracture was a fragility fracture and what the underlying bone disease is an area of emphasis that I believe will help adjudicate this new PSI. Let me get the number right. PSI 8, which is now called the in-hospital fracture rate. Now, another issue has to do with PSI 11. PSI 11 is the postoperative respiratory failure PSI, which is problematic for most of us because many physicians will write post-op respiratory failure in order to get critical care billing. Whether or not we should code the post-operative respiratory failure as a complication of surgery is a challenge for all of us. Now, one of the issues used to be that is that if the patient had any sort of dementia or delirium prior to fiscal year 2022, that could be an exclusion. In fiscal year 2022, it had to be present on admission. They've tightened it down even more now that for patients with dementia, it has to be a severe dementia. The doctor has to actually say the word severe, and there has to be an associated behavioral disturbance or a mood agitation or something of that nature in or a mild or moderate or unspecified dementia doesn't count for the some of these mood alterations. Now, to the best of my knowledge, DSM-5 does not differentiate the severity of dementia. It doesn't have criteria for what's mild, what's moderate, what's severe, and such. And as such, I'm going to say that that's going to be a problematic CDI issue for having some of these cases excluded, because what surgeon knows the differentiation between mild, moderate, and severe and such? So I'm going to say that that's an issue that we have to be sensitive to. Other aspects is that there, I have put a link of what the changes are in the comment section. There's going to be a lot of changes to PSI 15 as it relates to the accidental lacerations. Last but not least, let's talk about the risk adjustment. They are continuing to use the Ehlichhauser model, which if you're noticing on your software some Ehlichhauser scores, that is a very, very crucial aspect to what you're doing. Also, your front ends have to differentiate between elective admissions, which means that they were scheduled, versus urgent or emergent. And what I commonly see is that patients that are transferred out from other hospitals, you want to be able to capture that. They didn't come from home. They didn't come from a clinic or the such. Not only will they tremendously risk adjust your cases, but then you will also find for the U.S. News and World Reports, if that patient dies, that patient is excluded if they were transferred from another facility. So therefore, I ask for your attention to this. In solving this, preoperative assessments by perioperative workflows is crucial, documentation templates, and at some point in time, artificial intelligence, coupled with the UR criteria that we heard about earlier, I think is going to be essential for this. Thank you so much for the privilege, Erica. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thanks, Jim. That was Dr. James Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy is the founder of CDIMD Physician Champions.
Here now with a very popular segment of Talk to Tuesday is called Talk Back, and it features her own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it's all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. The 2024 Inpatient Prospective Payment System final rule came out in early August. Last week, Lori Johnson went over the changes, and I had the pleasure of serving as color commentator during the IPPS Summit. It is available on demand, as Chuck told us, and Clark told us, so feel free to register and see what you missed. Today, I'm going to present something I found very interesting and didn't really have time to talk about during the program. There are two sets of Medicare Severity Diagnosis-Related Groups, MSDRGs, which capture procedures unrelated to the principal diagnosis. MSDRGs 981 to 983 include extensive OR procedures, And MS-DRGs 987 to 989 refer to non-extensive OR procedures, each being a three-way split. If a patient is in a hospital for a severe exacerbation of heart failure, for instance, and they develop appendicitis requiring an appendectomy during their admission, their procedure is unrelated to the principal diagnosis of acute on chronic systolic heart failure, and they may fall into one of these DRGs. However, there are times when a patient has a principal diagnosis, which rationally leads to an operative procedure, clinically speaking, but the DRG logic triggers the unrelated characterization. My guess is these issues arise either from an oversight with the original logic or from a new approach or procedure being discovered to be useful for that condition and needing to be added to the logic. So let me illustrate. A patient has an abnormal communication between bowel and bladder, a vesiculo-intestinal fistula, N32.1. It is usually the sigmoid colon which is involved, and sometimes that part of the bowel must be resected. 0DTN4ZZ, resection of sigmoid colon, percutaneous approach, when performed in a patient with the principal diagnosis of N32.1 in the major diagnostic category MDC-11, diseases and disorders of the kidney and urinary tract, was landing in an extensive procedure unrelated to the principal diagnosis, MS-DRG. This did not make clinical sense. Open approach sigmoid resection was able to group to MS-DRG 673 to 675, other kidney and urinary tract procedures. I've concluded it was either an oversight or when the logic was assembled, percutaneous resection of the sigmoid colon wasn't being done maybe. The solution was to add the ICD-10 PCS code to MDC-11. Now, percutaneous resection of sigmoid colon can legitimately land in MS-DRGs 673 to 675, other kidney and urinary tract procedures. Another example concerned open excision of muscle. The most common cause was I-96 gangrene not elsewhere classified. Gangrene, as a principal diagnosis, is housed in MDC-05, diseases and disorders of the circulatory system. A mismatch when gangrene of muscle resulted in open excision of muscle plopped the encounters into an extensive procedure unrelated to the PDX DRG. CMS agreed that this was inappropriate, that the debridement was related to the diagnosis. The solution was to add MS-DRG 264 in MDC-05, other circulatory system OR procedures, to the list of allowable DRGs for I-96. Sometimes the mismatch results from a combination code located in MDC that doesn't correspond to the part of the combination triggering the procedure, like hypertensive heart and or chronic kidney disease, which is found in MDC-5. Ureteral dilation of the ureters with stents is most often done for obstruction, like from nephrolithiasis, in MDC-11. But if it is performed in MDC-5 to try to address failing kidneys, it has been grouping into MS-DRG 987 to 989. CMS is again adding MS-DRG 264 to the permissible DRGs for dilation of ureters with stenting. I found it interesting that a commenter suggested instead moving the PDX to MDC-11, but CMS declined because they feared this might result in other inadvertent unrelated procedure mismatches. The last change involves occlusion of the splenic artery with the PDX of major laceration of the spleen, and when they came up with the solution, they also had to change the name of the MS-DRG set to reflect the change, calling it splenic procedures instead of splenectomy. There were many other fascinating changes in the 2024 IPPS final rule. Feel free to check out my article in ICD-10 Monitor and to watch the IPPS Summit if you'd like to see the rest. Back to you, Chuck.
Thank you, Erica, very much. That was an excellent topic for your talk back. And folks, that's going to be your wrap for this live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. And I want to thank our panelists today as well. Tiffany Ferguson, Laurie Johnson, Tim Powell, Dr. Jim Kennedy, who reported our lead story, and of course, A special thank you to my dear friend, Dr. Erica Reamer, who co-hosts these Tucked In Tuesdays with me every Tuesday. And thank you again for joining us. Until next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Tucked In Tuesday. Have a great week, everybody.
Tucked In Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.